the lifeblood of global human activity, and increasingly, of individual human activity, no matter how pedestrian or mundane. Whether it was Alexa on your kitchen table, the phone in your pocket, or the hearing aid in your ear, computers were proliferating at an alarming rate. Tens of billions of ordinary items were coming online, the so-called Internet of Things. For all of the convenience, efficiency, productivity, and promise that the digital age was providing, the great sword of Damocles hanging over everyone's head was the insecurity of all of that data. Data was the gold stored in every device. Relentless thieves, including governments, criminal syndicates, and individual hackers, hungered to steal that gold. Early on, cyber thieves succeeded. New defenses were raised. Cyber security was born. By the early part of the 21st century, an extremely secure form of cybersecurity had been achieved through sophisticated encryption algorithms. These algorithms were analogous to a passcode, like a three-digit number for a lock on a gym locker. A simple three-digit locker passcode only has 1,000 possible combinations. But a 128-bit AES cipher passcode would require a conventional computer capable of a brute force attack of 1 trillion combinations per second for nearly 11 quintillion years, 18 zeros to break through. The hackers lost the brute force arms race because it was far easier to create more complicated software algorithms than it was to produce computer hardware fast enough to beat them. Thus, cybersecurity made the world safe for commerce and governments. Until tribulation. Tribulation would soon be what rapture could have been if the thieving politicians had left Parsons alone to finish the work she had started. But they didn't. So she created Tribulation, the world's first true universal 128-qubit quantum computer. Google's 72-qubit quantum machine, Bristlecone, recently solved one particular mathematical calculation in less than 4 minutes. The fastest conventional supercomputer would have required at least 10,000 years to solve the same problem. Impressive by any measure. Google claimed quantum supremacy. Google was wrong. Tribulation was far superior to the Google machine by orders of magnitude. And it wasn't only about the quantity of qubits. Generally speaking, there were two types of quantum computers: annealing, and universal. D-Wave deployed a 2,000-qubit annealing machine, but despite the larger number of qubits, its architecture limited its range of operations. But universal quantum machines like Bristlecone and Tribulation were virtually unlimited in their applications. What made 128-qubit Tribulation exponentially more powerful than 72-qubit Bristlecone was that each of Tribulation's 128 qubits was also quantumly entangled. This yielded more than 340 undecillion, 2 to the 128th power combinations of output states, a number so large it was nearly incomprehensible to the human mind. And Tribulation, unlike Bristlecone and other competitors, operated flawlessly, with a zero error rate. The significance of quantum computing was poorly understood outside of scientific circles. Sci-fi movie fans, doomsday preppers, and self-described futurists insisted that artificial intelligence, AI, was the greatest threat to humanity. They were wrong, too. In just over 11 hours and 43 minutes, Tribulation's quantum computer key could unlock any encrypted door on the planet. Nothing, absolutely nothing, that was digitized and stored accessibly would be secure once Tribulation came online. Parsons shut her laptop and headed for the computer room located in the most secure building, which was also the cleanest and coldest. To function properly, tribulation depended upon the controlled spin of superpositioned quantum particles, i.e., qubits. To maintain that controlled spin without interruption or interference, the machine required millikelvin temperatures to operate, temperatures approaching absolute zero, the point at which nearly all molecular activity ceases. If tribulation was a juggler spinning plates, qubits on the ends of her fingers, she couldn't have a monkey. Unwanted molecular movement, i.e. heat, jump on her arms and start grabbing her hands because she would lose control of the spinning plates, and they would crash. Of the many breakthroughs Parsons' teams had accomplished, stable, near-zero operations had been one of the most important. Parsons wanted to take another look at her machine. She could peer at Tribulation's magnificent architecture through a pane of tempered glass. She knew she would feel the love and longing of a mother gazing at her newborn daughter lying in an incubator, unable to touch her. But it was worth it. Parsons knew that in all likelihood, it would be the last time she'd see her creation, at least for a good long while. No matter. When the time was right, she'd be back to take full credit for whatever tribulation had wrought upon the earth, for good or for ill. Chapter 56, Washington, D.C., Dulles International Airport. The Lufthansa United Airlines Airbus A321 touched down 3 minutes ahead of schedule, the wheels hardly kissing the tarmac. Jack's mouth was full of cotton and spiders, or so it seemed to his aching skull and bleary eyes. He counted 3 little Jameson bottles stuffed in the seat pocket in front of him, but he couldn't remember how many of the free Heinekens he'd downed before, during, and after the teriyaki chicken dinner now souring in his gut. At least the booze had knocked him out. He slept like a log, but he felt like he'd been sleeping under one that had fallen on him from a great height. He could smell his own stink. He hadn't showered in over 32 hours, including a 12-hour stint in a Spanish jail, not exactly a French perfumery. He wanted to get out of his dirty clothes, take a long hot shower, and wash away the last few days before hitting the sack for about a week. He wasn't scheduled to report for duty with the campus for another few days. As the plane taxied toward its jet bridge, the flight attendant announced that it was okay to turn on electronics. Jack powered up his phone and saw that Gavin had texted. "Text me when you land. I'll pick you up." Jack groaned. The last thing he wanted to do was deal with the lumpy IT executive. A sweet guy, sure, and a nice enough offer, but Jack didn't need a buddy right now, just an Uber. Or a Lyft. Jack texted back. "Thanks, but I'll just grab an Uber. Talk tomorrow." The plane stood still on the tarmac, waiting for the jet bridge to clear. His phone dinged. Gavin again. "I'm already here. Couldn't wait to see you. So much to tell you." Jack shook his head. "Tell me now," Gavin replied. "It's too good not to tell you in person. Also, security." Jack rubbed his throbbing skull. After all that Gavin had done for him, this wasn't much of an ask. "Awesome. Can't wait." Jack checked for other messages, but nothing important had come over the transom. His stomach rumbled. He hoped he wasn't going to blow his cookies before he got off the plane. Jack climbed into Gavin's blood-red Chevy Silverado crew cab idling at the curb and tossed his laptop and carry-on into the back. The truck was so new it still had temporary paper plates. The cab was full of that new car smell, too. Also, the smell of French fries. Jack noticed several wadded-up fast food bags tossed in the back seat. He suddenly didn't feel so bad about smelling like a garbage truck. "Didn't take you for a truck guy, Gav." Gavin fired up the beefy 3.0-liter turbo diesel engine. Used to own a Dodge panel van, tricked out like I had back in high school. But the last girl I tried to pick up for a date saw me pull up to the curb and wouldn't come out of her house. I figured she thought it was a little too serial killery. He paused, adding, "The girl before that one, too." So I decided it was time to change my ride. Makes sense. So I upscaled to this cowboy Cadillac. It's a beautiful rig. Comes in real handy at the Renaissance fairs, too, let me tell you. Jack pulled out his wallet to pay for the parking as they rumbled up to the booth. Gavin pushed his wallet away. Friends don't let friends pay for airport parking. 10 minutes later, they were rolling along in silence on the wide four-lane VA-267 back toward Jack's apartment in Alexandria. Gavin was practically bouncing in his seat, bursting with excitement. But he was too polite to interrupt Jack's brooding thoughts. Jack's mood was as sour as his gut. But he finally relented. "So what is it that you wanted to tell me?" "Gosh, I don't know where to start. There's so much to talk about." "Try the beginning." "Okay, I'll start with Samler." Jack sat up. "You found him?"
"No."
"You did.
That guy you killed, Yakov?"
"Wait. How did you know that I killed him?"
"Dellinger uploaded a report on you. He was nice enough to include the Byakov autopsy photo, which is how I ran down his ID. My face recreating program wasn't cutting it."
"You hacked into the CIA mainframe?"
"Had to. I'm on overwatch, keeping an eye out for my buddy in the field."
"Well, thanks for that. So why do you think Byakov is Samler?"
"I don't. Samler isn't a person. It's an organization. I mean, it's all rumors and hearsay. But if half of what's out there is true, these guys are way beyond the pale. They break a lot of things and hurt a lot of people for anybody for the right price. Or used to."
"What do you mean?"
"They dropped off the radar a few years back. Rumor was they disbanded. But these people are evil. Like evil empire stormtrooper evil. The kind of evil that doesn't just quit. Think of Wagner, only worse."
"Dellinger told me just this morning that Byakov was ex-Wagner, ex-Russian military, and reported dead long before I killed him."
"You killed a dead guy? That's got to be some kind of record."
"I'm starting to see why you think Byakov was Samler. He was ex-military. Most contracting outfits recruit those kinds of guys. And Samler is a contractor."
Gavin's eyes widened.
"Oh, man. These Samler guys aren't like any other contractors you ever heard of. They're real old school. They're all about the money, for sure, but not just the money. They've got some kind of a loyalty cult, sort of a cross between the Samurai Bushido Code and Legio Patria Nostra."
"The Legion is our homeland. The motto of the French Foreign Legion."
"Yeah. And toss in a little Mafia Omerta on top and a dose of Fight Club, and all of a sudden you have a band of super-secret, super-loyal, psycho-killer blood brothers who never talk about themselves or what they do."
"That explains why it was so hard to find Van Delden before. Maybe he was with Samler, too.
Get this. They're so serious about their honor and loyalty that they do that Cold War thing where they put a cyanide capsule under a false tooth in order to take themselves out rather than get captured."
Jack suddenly saw the puzzle pieces falling into place. "After I punched Byakov in the mouth, he rubbed his chin and gave me this weird little smile before he dropped dead.
I'm waiting for the Spanish coroner to file his complete autopsy report, but I'll bet you a bag of Popeye's fried chicken sandwiches that it'll show cyanide or some other poison."
Jack's mind flashed back to the steel mill. "Now that I think about it, Van Delden slammed his fist into his jaw a couple of times just before he jumped over the railing. I couldn't figure out why. I guess when his capsule didn't work, he knew the only way he wasn't going to get captured was to kill himself the hard way. I'll be damned. And if Byakov really was with Samler, you know what that means. It means Samler is responsible for Renee's murder. And Laya's. And Pena's. What the hell are these guys up to? And maybe Runso's murder, too. Unless Runso was only collateral damage. Speaking of Runso, any progress on the Rapture project?
Oh, yeah, that's the second thing I wanted to tell you about.
Go for it.
Well, I'm still not exactly sure what Rapture is, but I know where it is.
Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's connected to the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. Oak Ridge? As in the Manhattan Project?
Yep. More brainiacs per square mile than,
well, I don't know where. Nuclear weapons research, fusion research, quantum mechanics, materials science, aerospace engineering, precision manufacturing, you name it, they do it all, and they do it for the DOD, DOE, NASA, and even the private sector. Maybe I should head down to Oak Ridge. Only if you want to get arrested and renditioned out to a Romanian secret prison, there's no way anyone not in that program can know about that program. You will be presumed guilty of espionage until you can prove your innocence, which is kind of hard to do when you're shackled to a basement wall with a car battery jumper cabled to your McNuggets. Jack's head still throbbed, but a shot of adrenaline suddenly cleared his mind. You said before that Runso was some kind of consultant. What company was he consulting for?
He was his own boss.
His work address is in Knoxville, Tennessee. That's not too far from ORNL, Jack said. Or the University of Tennessee.
Go Vols,
Gavin said, pumping one fist.
You were full of surprises tonight.
I had no idea you were a football guy.
I'm not. Women's basketball is where it's at. Pat Summitt was one of the greatest NCAA coaches of all time. My mother used to play there. Mom and I never miss a game.
They rolled along for a few minutes, Jack's mind turning back to Runso. What was a nuclear physicist doing in Spain? Why sneak into Barcelona? Was it a coincidence that a CIA operative working for a technology front was in the same restaurant as he was? Or was he intentionally coming there to meet her? Or was he there to meet Alexandrie? Was Runso delivering some kind of a warning about Rapture to Renee? Or selling secrets to Brigada Catalan? Did Samler intend to kill Runso, or was he collateral damage? And maybe the most important question of all, was Samler somehow connected to Rapture? Questions are more powerful than answers, his dad always used to say. Right now, he'd settle for answers. Questions like these only made his head hurt more than it already did, especially when the answers were so far out of reach. Jack knew that the key to answering those questions was to figure out whether Runso was a patriot or a traitor, and the answer to that question wasn't going to be found in the cab of a Chevy Silverado. I've got to go to Knoxville and chase down this lead on Runso.
I'm going with you.
I don't think so, Gav. You never know what kind of trouble might be waiting down there. The team's not back yet. You're the only operator in the area, and you know the rules. You never go in alone.
Gav, look, Rapture is technical, whatever it is, and you're, well, physical. I'm the technical guy. So you go do the physical stuff, I'll take care of the rest.
I want to head out first thing tomorrow morning. Let's get you back to your place, and you can take care of your business, and maybe even take a shower. I'll make all of the arrangements and text you with the flight schedule as soon as I have it. Deal? Jack's head hurt too much to argue. Deal.
Chapter 57. Labrador Sea, 345 miles due south of the Greenland coast. The tip of the shark's dorsal fin slipped beneath the surface of the frigid water. Had anyone seen it, they might have thought it odd. The location was approximately 900 miles north of where RMS Titanic struck an iceberg and sank in April 1912. No icebergs were floating around in the area this time of year. Most of the glacial calving on the coast of Greenland happened in the warmer temperatures of late spring and early summer. Favoring warmer waters where food sources thrived,
Tiger sharks were frequently found in tropical and subtropical areas, like the Caribbean or the Gulf of Mexico. But they were commonly seen in the Pacific waters near Australia, New Zealand, and the islands of the South Pacific. They have also been spotted in the colder waters of the Northern Pacific and the Atlantic. Known to live as long as 50 years, these great fish are capable of circumnavigating the globe in the course of their lifespans. The tiger shark is one of the largest predatory shark species on the planet, just slightly smaller than the more famous great white. They are nomadic animals who mostly follow the warm water currents. Their insatiable hunt for food includes all manner of fish, and also giant sea turtles, dolphins, octopi, manta rays, seabirds, sea lions, and even other sharks. Fishermen have split open the stomachs of these ravenous beasts and discovered in whole or in part rats, cats, horses, monkeys, cushions, coats, car tires, and even explosives. A pelagic species, tiger sharks usually inhabit the deep waters beyond the continental shelf, sometimes over 400 feet below the surface. Sometimes they venture closer to the coast. They are perfectly designed for long journeys in deep water and capable of short bursts of speed on the attack. The largest tiger shark ever caught was just under 24 feet in length and weighed nearly 7,000 pounds. Typically, they are half that length and a third that weight. In overall shape, length, and weight, the average tiger shark is quite similar to the human-designed Mark 48 torpedo. The Canadian-owned freighter Emerald Glory was a Liberian-flagged vessel. The term of art was Flag of Convenience, which was quite apt. Registering a vessel under the Liberian flag was a legal and convenient way for the owners to avoid the burdensome costs of additional taxes, environmental regulations, union wages, and maintenance requirements that a Canadian flag would have necessitated. This saved the owners over $3 million per year. The Emerald Glory had been loaded in the port of Montreal with a variety of cargoes, most of it in containers, but not all. Shipments of forklifts, excavators, gas turbines, plywood, fiberboard, and fuel wood were all bound for Aberdeen, Scotland, and Grimsby, Immingham, on the east coast of England, the busiest port in the UK. The Emerald Glory was making just over 11 knots on a northerly route in the frigid waters of the Labrador Sea, a decent speed for her aging and fuel-inefficient engines. Her current location, speed, direction, and ports of destination were all broadcast on her AIS and available on a variety of commercial websites. There were a number of people who monitored her live AIS broadcast, including those who intended to destroy her. The tiger shark swam at a very low rate of speed, just above that of the eastbound current that carried the Emerald Glory along. The shark was, in fact, exactly in line with the ship as it approached from some 2,000 yards away. This particular shark was more than 18 feet in length and weighed nearly 4,000 pounds, neither of which was particularly unusual for the species. Had the fish been hauled aboard one of the many fishing trawlers that harvested the fruit of the North Atlantic waters, they would have discovered several differences between this tiger shark and those typical to the species. The single biggest difference was simply this. The tiger, now diving below the surface of the frigid waters of the Labrador Sea, was an autonomous drone. God, or nature's god, evolution, depending upon one's metaphysical orientation, was the world's greatest designer. And few designs exceeded the hydrodynamic efficiency of the tiger shark. Biomimicry was widely adopted in many forms of drone technology. Rather than try and reinvent the wheel, the designers of the tiger shark drone let nature be their guide. Whereas actual tiger sharks were designed to hunt for food and reproduce, the tiger shark drone was designed to destroy commercial shipping vessels. This necessitated a few changes in God's design. Not that it needed any improvements in form, only in function. That function was not unlike the American-designed and manufactured Mark 48 torpedo, one of the world's great undersea weapons, A lone sonar-guided, high-speed Mark Fish was capable of single-handedly destroying a surface or submerged warship. The latest Mark 48 models weighed about 3,500 pounds, including a 650-pound payload of high explosives. Much of the torpedo's remaining weight was due to the onboard liquid fuel propellant that drove the heavy swashplate cam engine. The Mark 48's high-speed pump jet propulsion produced speeds exceeding 60 miles per hour underwater. The internal components and high-speed performance necessitated a metal skin and rigid architecture to maintain the torpedo's structural integrity from launch to impact. The other requirement for the Mark 48 torpedo system was a delivery platform, which included every submarine class in the U.S. inventory. Delivery platforms like submarines and surface vessels were extraordinarily expensive, complex, large, and heavily crewed. In short, the brilliant engineers at the U.S. Naval Surface Warfare Center designed the Mark 48 to attain high speeds, dive to great depths, and overcome defensive countermeasures in order to seek and destroy fast-moving, deep-diving enemy subs, their primary targets. The challenge for the designers of the Tiger Shark drone was to combine the hydrodynamic efficiencies of the Shark with the destructive potential of a torpedo. While these two design characteristics were seemingly at odds, God versus the Naval Surface Warfare Center, in fact, the solution was relatively straightforward. The Tiger Shark drone design variations from the Mark 48 torpedo all stemmed from the variation in targets. The Mark 48 weapon system was designed for combat against fast, stealthy, deep-diving submarines capable of high-speed defensive maneuvers. This required fast, deep-diving torpedoes with advanced target acquisition capabilities. But the Tiger Shark drone targets were slow-moving, non-diving commercial cargo vessels that deployed neither stealth nor any other defensive countermeasures. That made commercial cargo vessels extremely vulnerable to slow-moving weapon systems like the Drone Shark. With that kind of target, the Tiger Shark drone design solutions immediately suggested themselves. First and foremost, a slow-moving drone could carry a larger payload, 2,600 pounds of high explosive, four times greater than what the Mark 48 deployed. Slow-moving targets allowed a slow-moving weapon. This meant the drone required lower energy output and energy use. The battery-powered electric-motored Tiger drone had plenty of both in reserve. When first described to Samler, the chief design engineer compared the 4,000-pound, 16-foot Tiger drone to a submersible 2020 Tesla Roadster, but with fins instead of tires. The all-electric Tesla Roadster was capable of achieving 0 to 60 miles per hour in 1.9 seconds and could travel over 600 miles at highway speeds on a single charge of its 200-kilowatt-hour lithium-ion battery. But the Tiger Shark drone wasn't turning four tires at maximum speed on high-friction asphalt in order to chase down a fast-moving target. In fact, the drone didn't have to move at all. It could simply drift for hours, if not days, without expending any energy whatsoever, as it waited for its target to arrive at the Drone Shark's location. Even if it ran continuously at its average speed of 13 knots per hour, it would still have a range of over 2,400 miles on a single charge. Thanks to its 800-volt architecture stolen from the Porsche Design Bureau, it could recharge 80% of its capacity in just 15 minutes. A particular genius of the Tiger Shark drone system was its targeting program. In fact, the drone relied on the commercial vessel to target itself via its own AIS transmissions. Once the target was selected, the Tiger drone positioned itself somewhere along the vessel's path via the drone's onboard AI program or by remote human operation. Whereas a conventional submarine and torpedo system had to find and chase an enemy vessel, a deployed Tiger drone passively awaited the arrival of its target. There were many other advantages to the Tiger drone design, including its stealth capabilities. Noise, heat, size, wave propagation, and magnetic anomalies were the primary means of detecting submersible and surface vessels. The Tiger drone avoided or mitigated all of these. First, its primary means of propulsion, a swishing tail, produced 1/10 the acoustical noise of a conventional propeller, though the Shark had one of these for emergency use or for microbursts of speed. Second, the Tiger drone's outer hide was comprised of just 4 millimeters of bubble-infused, bubble-wrap latex skin. This dampened sonar signals by as much as 99% and reduced radar wave detection by a factor of 10,000. A secondary layer of rubber added extra stability and helped shield the few metallic internal components, including its 2 small and nearly silent electric motors, weighing just 70 pounds each. Third, the skeleton of the fish was comprised of non-metallic polycarbonate bones, and the propeller shaft and propeller were constructed from German-designed carbon fiber reinforced plastics, CFRP. Finally, the dorsal fin of the drone served as its antenna, able to send and receive encrypted comms and location signals. It was also able to independently receive and track the AIS signals of any commercial vessel worldwide. And of course, high-def digital cameras were located behind the clear lenses of the drone's eyes. Taken all together, the Tiger drone was practically invisible to sonar, radar, heat, or magnet anomaly detection. But in the extremely unlikely event one of them popped up on screen or scope, the size and shape of the signature would indicate exactly what it appeared to be: a lone shark in the water, not a fast-moving, metal-skinned submarine or torpedo. Biomimicry at its best. The research lab that designed the Tiger Shark drone knew that another significant technical problem still faced them: the delivery platform. Because of their limited range, Mark 48 torpedoes were delivered to combat areas by submarines and launched from tubes within the vessel. While the Tiger Shark had far wider range than a torpedo, it wasn't capable of completely independent movement. Eventually, its battery would be exhausted, or mechanical issues might arise. And given its slow speed, it would take many days, if not weeks, to arrive in its zone of operation if launched from its point of origin. The delivery system option was even more obvious to the designers than the biomimicry fish solution for the weapons platform itself. What better delivery system for a drone fish than a fish trawler? These trawler motherships were, in fact, converted deep-water fishing vessels, with all of the appropriate gear to pass any unlikely inspection. Modern fishing vessels deployed sonar, radar, navigation, and comms that did double duty as drone support equipment. In addition, these disguised motherships possessed both battery recharging platforms for the sharks and drone repair facilities. In the event of an emergency, the sharks could be caught by the motherships and either towed or brought on board and redeployed elsewhere. In the unlikely event one of the Tiger Shark drones was captured by an enemy vessel, the onboard munitions would self-destruct when the machine was lifted vertically unless the gyroscope motion detector was deactivated by its mothership commander. There were 5 mothership vessels deployed around the world, and each deployed 6 shark drones. Once deployed in the water, the sharks were given an AIS signal to track. The drone's onboard computer automatically attacked the vessel in question. The shark drone dove under the hull and exploded, breaking the spine of the ship and destroying its structural integrity with a single but massive charge equivalent to 4 Mark 48 torpedoes. Without question, the Tiger drone weapon system would have been of limited value in direct confrontation in a wartime scenario with a major seafaring power, but that wasn't its purpose. The Tiger drone program was a new kind of piracy, operated by a new kind of pirate. Lucrative, yes, but temporarily so. It was a means to an end. Its primary purpose was to distract the United States from an even more dangerous and terrifying operation that had only begun to unfold. The Emerald Glory broke apart instantly, its 2 halves sinking in less than 7 minutes. Miraculously, 3 crew members survived the blast. Without lifeboat or vests, they treaded the bone-chilling waters for less than 20 minutes. Each died in turn as their numbing muscles failed. Helpless to avoid slipping beneath the surface, they perished, swallowing the sea in whimpering gasps, their corpses bluing in the water as they waited for a rescue that never came. October 30th. Chapter 58. Alexandria, Virginia. Jack stood ready at the curb in front of his house, checking his watch. Shaved, showered, and rested. He was waiting for Gavin, who finally pulled up in his Silverado an hour before sunrise. Jack tossed his buffalo leather carry-on in the cab and followed in after it. "You're late." "Can't be late if we're the only passengers," Gavin said with a smile as he sped off for the airport. "And I wanted to get you a coffee." Gavin pointed at the large black Dunkin' Donuts coffee in Jack's cup holder. Jack saw the flakes of croissant on Gavin's shirt and assumed another crumpled bag now lay in the back. "Appreciate it. Next stop, Knoxville." Jack and Gavin boarded the Cirrus G2 Vision Jet parked at Signature, the Dulles FBO. The nice thing about flying private, particularly on a Hendley plane, was that Jack could carry his weapon, a single-stack slimline Glock 43 9mm. He carried it in a Black Dog IWB deep concealment holster beneath his sport coat, along with a spare 6-round mag. The new Cirrus G2 was a powerful but diminutive personal one-pilot jet with seating arranged for just 2 passengers that morning. Hendley Associates purchased the G2 as an alternative to its giant fuel-guzzling Gulfstream G550 used for international flights. The V-tailed single-engine G2 was fast, powerful, and economical. It had a glass flight deck and side sticks that looked like something from a Star Trek episode, with automated flight controls to match. Jack was impressed with its luxury comfort and visibility in the small cabin. His flight-phobic dad would have loved the safety features. These included an emergency one-button safe return autoland and the one-lever parachute system that landed the aircraft in an upright position. Captain Helen Reed, the senior pilot for Hendley Associates, was at the controls. She'd already been scheduled for a trip to Knoxville later in the week for the G2's annual maintenance at the Cirrus facility at McGee Tyson Airport in Alcoa. She was happy to switch her schedule on short notice for Gavin and Jack. They reached their cruising altitude of 31,000 feet in short order. "I wanted to bounce an idea off you," Gavin said. "Shoot." "I couldn't get to sleep last night, so I did some messing around on one of my tech blogs, catching up on the latest goings-on. Have you heard of Chris and Carrie Fast?" "No, can't say that I have." "They were two of the most important researchers at Google's AI Quantum Labs in Mountain View. They were found murdered just 4 days ago. Some kind of crazy satanic ritual." "That's sick." "Yeah, it is. And apparently they left their entire $30 million estate to a no-kill animal shelter in San Francisco. That's what the board was buzzing about, bitching that it should have gone to the homeless instead. But their murders got me to thinking, so I started nosing around. And then I found an NSA internal memo on the suicide of Dr. Stanley Hopkins. That really bummed me out. I actually met him once at a London conference a few years ago. He was lecturing on the challenges of cryptography in a post-quantum world. Dude was spooky smart. Emphasis on spooky."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning, he was a spook. Or at least working at GCHQ.
"Keep going."
"Yeah, 2 points make a line. So I followed the line. And you know what else I found? There are 5 other world-class researchers all connected in one way or another to quantum cybersecurity that have died in the last year."
"And no one else has made that connection?"
Gavin shrugged. "They all happened in different countries, and all the deaths were completely different. Ritualistic murder, suicide, motorcycle accident, drowning, accidental overdose, an armed robbery gone bad, and carbon monoxide poisoning. Even if you were looking for a connection, you wouldn't have necessarily found it. But then again, genius is seeing the obvious."
"Well then, friend genius,
Who's the obvious culprit behind these killings? Still working on that one. They rode along for a moment. Jack said, Do you think Runso could be another link in that chain of killings? Depends on whatever it was he was doing at ORNL with the Rapture Project. Given his background, do you think he could have been working in cybersecurity? I don't see why not. He could have been working on the hardware side of things, since he was a physicist. And if Samler is behind Runso's death, then maybe they might be responsible for these other deaths, too. I can see that. But Samler is just a crew of hired guns. We definitely need to find them, but we really need to find who hired them. Jack sighed, frustrated. It was deja vu all over again. He was right back where he started with Van Delden, his first dead end. Then Bykov, also a dead end. We don't have any more links in the Samler chain, Gavin said. It's like we're free climbing the face of El Capitan. No way to get to the top. No, but we've got Runso. If we can figure out exactly why he was killed, that might be a handhold we can work with. And if Runso is just another dead end? Then I start pulling out pitons and driving them into somebody's skull. Chapter 59, Alcoa, Tennessee, McGee Tyson Airport. After they landed and Captain Reed secured the G2 at the Cirrus maintenance hangar, Jack and Gavin grabbed the rental waiting for them outside the Cirrus offices. It was a four-door silver Jeep Wrangler soft top with a high-end worn Xeon winch fixed to the front bumper. I picked the Wrangler in case we want to explore the Smoky Mountains while we're here, Gavin offered. And I thought we'd look cool in it. Jack climbed in behind the wheel and Gavin punched the business address he'd found from Runso's tax records into the Garmin GPS navigator. The Garmin sent them north on the 129 Alcoa Highway toward Knoxville. Runso's office was just 15 miles distant. But the roads were redlined all the way up because they were hitting morning rush hour traffic, miles of construction slowdowns, and navigating at least one wreck on the highway. Add to that the stop-and-go traffic on Kingston Pike, and what should have taken 24 minutes was now costing them more than an hour. Jack checked his frustration. It wasn't as if they were in a rush. There wasn't a ticking clock pointed like a gun at their heads. They were just chasing the one lead they had, not even exactly sure of what they were looking for, let alone what they might find when they got there. What they found when they finally arrived was entirely underwhelming. The address led them directly to a UPS store. As expected, when they went inside, Jack and Gavin found that the suite number of Runso's business address was just the number on a mailbox, one of dozens. There was no window on the mailbox, and therefore no way to tell if it was full, empty, or even in use. Now what? Gavin said. Follow my lead, Jack said, ginning up his seductive powers. He approached the middle-aged, heavyset woman behind the counter. She wore black stretch pants, a blue Oxford work shirt, and bright green eyeshadow. May I help you? She asked, behind a pair of thick glasses. Jack smiled broadly, locking eyes with her. A friend of mine has a business address that's located here in one of your mailboxes. His name is Dr. Dylan Runso. He owns a consulting firm. Synergy Solutions, Gavin said, standing just behind Jack. This Runso fella must have a lot of friends. Oh, why do you say that? Jack asked. Because you're not the first ones to stop by and ask about him. What is it that you want exactly? He's out of town, and he's asked me to come down and fetch his mail out of his box. The woman's eyes narrowed. I'll tell you what I told the others. Unless you're on his paperwork as an authorized user, I can't let you do that. What if I told you he gave me permission? Do you have anything in writing? He called me just a few minutes ago. Then how about you call him right back and I'll talk to him? I wish I could. He just went into an important meeting and can't be reached. The woman parked her big fists on her even bigger hips. Honey, do I look like I just fell off the turnip truck? Gavin barked a laugh, like a circus seal. The woman glanced over Jack's shoulder and gave Gavin the stink eye. He withered and turned aside.
No, ma'am, you don't, Jack said. But this is really important.
I'm sure it is.
Jack pulled out a billfold and flashed a fake ID, along with a fake badge. He held it up to her face, and she grabbed it with both of her red-nailed hands and read it while he was still holding it.
U.S. Department of Homeland Investigations.
She let go of Jack's billfold.
Another fit.
Another?
Can we see the contents of that mailbox?
I'll tell you what I told those FBI people. Unless you have a warrant signed by a judge, I can't let you in there.
Jack pocketed his phony credentials.
Then I guess I'll have to go and get one.
No use, hon.
Why not?
Don't you feds talk to each other?
The FBI already came back with one and emptied out that box 2 days ago.
Wasn't much in it, near as I can tell. Not that I read my customers' mail, mind you.
Jack shook his head, feigning disgust.
You know how it is back in D.C. It's just one giant goat rodeo.
Ain't it the truth, she said, nodding in agreement.
Wait a minute.
The woman searched beneath her counter, then came up with a business card and handed it to Jack.
That was the FBI lady in charge. She and another fella came in here.
The woman touched her red index nail to the name.
She spells it K-A-N-G, but she pronounces it Kong.
Give her a call. She was nice enough.
The bell on the glass door tinkled as another customer came in.
Thanks. That's really helpful.
Jack pocketed the card.
Sorry to bother you.
No bother at all, hon. Good luck.
And thank you both for your service.
Ouch. Chapter 60. Washington, D.C. Situation Room. The White House.
For this emergency meeting, the long mahogany table was crowded with more principals. The chairs along the walls were occupied by department and agency staffers, mostly military. Each principal had given a brief summary of their findings and concerns. The latter was a considerable list. It all amounted to a seemingly insoluble challenge. Ryan called this latest meeting as soon as he got word about the Labrador sea sinking from Admiral Talbot before his day had even begun. They all had been lulled into a false sense of victory after the Glazov was forced to the surface and perp-walked back to Russia 3 days ago. But the sinking of yet another ship in the Indian Ocean had shattered that illusion. Now the news of this additional sinking in the Labrador Sea proved the crisis was spinning out of control. Nobody knew who was behind the attacks, how they were conducted, or where the next ones would take place.
It's like we're boxing with blindfolds and earplugs, was the way Arnie put it, and the ring just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
These escalating attacks by an unknown hostile, deploying an assumed but as yet unidentified weapons system, threatened to destabilize the global economy. This was the worst crisis Ryan's administration had ever faced, and he took full responsibility for it. Ryan needed more hands on deck if he hoped to get ahead of this thing. DARPA sent over a department head and two leading researchers working on extra-large unmanned undersea vehicles, XLUUVs, and Admiral Talbot flew two officers in from the Naval Undersea Warfare Center in Keyport, Washington, the commander of Submarine Development Squadron DEVRON 5, and the commander of the newly formed Unmanned Undersea Vehicle Squadron, UUVRON 1. Ryan scanned the room. All eyes were on him. These were earnest, serious people looking for guidance and, more important, confidence. They were scared. So was he. Ryan knew they weren't looking for answers, because there weren't any. They wanted leadership. Ryan stood.
We're standing right in front of a brick wall, no two ways about it, Ryan began.
A wall so tall and wide we can't comprehend it. Randy Pausch was right about brick walls. They're there to show us how badly we want something, and they only stop the people who don't want it badly enough.
I know most of you in this room, and more important, you know me. You know how badly I want to find and stop whoever is behind these attacks. I don't know how we're going to do it. I don't know how long it's going to take.
What I do know is that the Labrador incident is the first lucky break we've had, because it's the first sinking we've been able to detect in real time, thanks to Sibbers picking up the thermal flare. The second lucky break is that it appears to be a simple, conventional chemical explosion, and definitely not nuclear, according to Massint. The third thing we know is that no known hostile combat aircraft were in the area, and no cruise, ballistic, or hypersonic missiles were detected before, during, or after the attack. Which I believe is connected to the fourth thing in our favor. D&I Foley has assured us that there has been no Chinese or Russian chatter about these events, and Sexstate Adler has not received any back-channel communications from either principals or opposition from within their respective governments. We still don't know who is behind all of this, but we are now reasonably confident it isn't the Russians or the Chinese, which takes the World War III scenario off the table. Now it's time to roll up our sleeves and find a way to get our tails over, under, around, or through this goddamn brick wall. Who's coming with me? Ryan sensed rather than heard a collective sigh of relief around the table. Nodding heads and smiles told him he won the room over. We're with you, Mr. President, all the way, Foley said. More nodding heads, even a few laughs. Not a bad little pep talk, Ryan thought. If only I believed it myself. The room's secure door opened, and Ruby Knox, the temporary lead agent of the Presidential Protective Division, approached him. That wasn't good. The PPD knew exactly how important this meeting was. Nothing short of an even greater national emergency should be interrupting it. Excuse me, Ryan said to the table as he stepped closer to Knox and out of earshot from the others in the room. What is it? Ryan asked in a low voice. The Treasury Secretary is in the Oval, along with the Chairman of the Federal Reserve. They've requested a meeting with you ASAP. Ryan frowned, genuinely confused. I've got more important things on my plate right now than worrying about the ECB dropping interest rates a quarter point next week. Knox nodded. I explained that to them, sir, but they're quite insistent. Did they tell you what it's all about? I'm just the hired help, sir. What do you think? I think Sec Trej Hodge is going to stroke out if you don't get up there pronto, and if I'm not mistaken, Chairman Moorcroft has already pooped his pantaloons. Sir. Chapter 61. The White House. Agent Knox opened the northeast door leading from the President's Secretary's office into the Oval. Sec Trej Hodges and Chairman Moorcroft were sitting together on one of the long couches. Both men bolted to their feet when the door opened, and President Ryan and Arnie Van Dam marched in. Knox closed the door behind them for privacy and security. The two financial executives each wore expensive, tailored gray suits. Hodges wore a silk rep Harvard tie and held a leather folio in a white-knuckled grip. Moorcroft wore a bright yellow bow tie and glasses. Ryan beelined to the two men and waved them back to their seats on the couch. Both executives were in their mid-60s and in good health, and known for their steady nerves and keen minds navigating the turbulent world of global and domestic finance. It scared the hell out of Ryan that both men were visibly shaken. Gentlemen, please, let's forget the formalities. What's going on? You two look like you've seen a ghost. Ryan took one of the chairs and Arnie grabbed the couch opposite the two financial wizards. Hodges opened his folio, pulled a letter from it, and handed it to Ryan. He also gave Arnie a copy. Mr. President, Hodges began, our offices simultaneously received this letter approximately 1 hour ago. You can read the details in full later, but the letter claims, and unfortunately my office has verified that claim, that $5 trillion has been stolen from the accounts of the world's 100 largest banking institutions. No one moved. No one breathed. They couldn't. Now wait one goddamn New York minute, Arnie said. He leaned forward, his face a welter of confusion. Did you really just say $5 trillion? With a T? I'm afraid so, Hodges said. And it's already stolen, gone, just disappeared. Yes. Arnie threw his hands in the air. That's utter bullshit. Unfortunately, it's not, Moorcroft said.
It's absolutely accurate. We've verified with over 42 banks so far, and others are reaching out to my office even as we speak. I've already been contacted by the presidents of Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase, Hodges said. 18 of the world's largest banks are Chinese, including the top four. The U.S. has 12 of the largest banks, Japan 8, France, South Korea, and the U.K. each have 6, Canada, Germany, and Spain 5. My counterparts at the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan reached out to me within minutes of the letter, the Federal Reserve chairman said. England, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand as well. These are all sober and imperturbable men and women, and I'm telling you, they are scared witless.
What about the Chinese? Ryan asked.
When I didn't hear from them, I took it upon myself to reach out to the governor of the People's Bank of China. I hope I didn't overstep my authority, but time is not our friend.
You did exactly the right thing, Ryan said.
Thank you, sir.
What did the Chinese say?
The governor hasn't responded to my repeated calls. They're clearly stonewalling. Not surprising, really, given the way they work. The PBOC is an organ of the Chinese Communist Party, like almost everything else over there. In a crisis like this, the governor isn't going to communicate with any outsiders without official instructions from the higher-ups.
Unless they're the ones behind all of this, Arnie offered.
Ryan thought of that, too.
And what about the Russians?
They have only one bank in the top 100, Sberbank, Hodges said.
We have, shall we say, third-party access to their organization. Apparently, they have not been hit.
Interesting, Ryan thought. Fits perfectly with the improved kilo-class scenario. He couldn't share that with the finance men, though he would need to read Hodges into that crisis soon, before word got out about it, and that crisis started a global economic panic.
$5 trillion? Arnie asked again. It's mind-boggling. How is that even possible?
Digitally, of course, Hodges said.
Only 8% of global money is actual physical currency these days, Ryan said. The other 92% is just ones and zeros on a hard drive somewhere.
Hodges pointed at the piece of paper in Arnie's hand.
Read the letter, Mr. Van Dam. It appears the thieves have acquired the technical means to break into each of these banks and rob the till, so to speak. Whoever it is used a computer they call Tribulation.
Ryan pulled on his reading glasses and scanned the letter. His eyes fell upon one particular passage. His blood ran cold. Your best interest is to make arrangements to cover my theft. Do not pursue me, or I will retaliate. You are dealing with the person who created the first true quantum computer. Everything is open to me. All of your secret files, all of your official lies, all of your weapons systems and energy grids, every savings account, every retirement account, every investment account. Corporations and governments are equally exposed. Everything is open to me. But I'm not greedy. $5 trillion is enough for what I have planned. Within the next several months, I'm confident that the world will have developed quantum cyber defenses against me, so my window of opportunity will close. Which is your only hope. And now, gentlemen, please convey this special message to President Ryan. Do not pursue me. You will fail. If you attempt to pursue me, I will burn your world to the ground, starting with a press release detailing my theft. My silence is your only protection. As proof of your commitment not to pursue me, you will personally instruct Chairman Moorcroft to deposit $100 billion into the account described below by 9 a.m. EST. We both know the chairman has the power to do that. After all, didn't he print $16 trillion out of thin air to bail out your too-big-to-fail bankster buddies? If you fail to make the deposit by 9 a.m. EST, I will unleash unimaginable chaos.
I don't understand, Arnie said. Is he saying that if we pay the $100 billion, he'll return the $5 trillion?
Ryan shook his head. No. He or she, is keeping the 5 trillion. That's an all-out assault on the world. But the additional $100 billion is directed at me, jerking my chain. Somehow, this is personal. Hodges said, if he really has constructed the world's first true quantum computer, he's perfectly capable of overwhelming the encryption security protecting the world's largest financial institutions, just as he claims. What does the theft of $5 trillion do to these banks? To the global monetary supply? Ryan asked. The questions were rhetorical. His background in Wall Street investing gave him a firm grasp of markets and money. For the banks, it's absolutely devastating, Hodges said. Their primary function is lending money. Without money, their function ceases. If families and businesses can't borrow money to buy homes or make products, the global economy collapses. The only good news I've heard from the banks so far is that they have each been left with enough operating capital to last them the rest of the week, Hodges said. Moorcroft added, for the global money supply, it's a somewhat different story. Global money supply is approximately $90 trillion. The choice of the $5 trillion figure is an interesting one. The theft has removed only about 5.5% of that total. You make it sound like it's no big deal, Arnie said. A nickel out of a dollar. Oh no, Mr. Van Damme, it's a really big deal. Maybe the biggest of all time. If people discover their life savings and college funds and checking accounts have all been emptied out, they'll lose complete confidence in the monetary system as we know it. It will be the end of capitalism. Hodges leaned forward for emphasis. We're not talking about a temporary banking or stock market or real estate crisis like we've experienced over the last few decades. Those were bad, sure, but they were part of the business cycle, and we bounced back from all of those. But this? There won't be any bouncing back. If there's a global economic collapse and trust in the currency is destroyed, capitalism will be irretrievably discredited. And I think we all know what comes next. Lenin, Hitler, Stalin, Tojo, Mussolini. They were all products of economic collapse, Ryan said. And the result was war. Civil, regional, global. We're talking an economic apocalypse, Moorcroft said, and a political one. Chapter 62. Sec-Trej Hodges and Chairman Moorcroft stared ashen-faced at the president. Ryan shared their concern, but now was not the time to quail. Ryan tried to hide his rage along with his growing sense of panic. Every major government in the world was chasing quantum computing. A quantum computing arms race was raging across the globe. He had convinced Congress to take the threat seriously and help speed along the research rather than simply wait for the private sector to figure it out. The stakes were too high to let a bad actor acquire quantum computing first, as today was proving out. Quantum computing would be the technological equivalent of nuclear weapons for the 21st century. And suddenly, the United States was completely disarmed. He's put a countdown clock on us, Mr. President. 2, actually. First, as you've just read, he demands we deposit a sum of $100 billion into an account he's specified within the next. Hodges checked his Patek Philippe Genève watch. 47 minutes as proof you'll not pursue him. He's badly mistaken if he thinks I won't hound his ass to the gates of hell and back. But to buy time, I'm authorizing you to make the deposit. Very good, Mr. President. I assumed you'd agree to his condition, and I've prearranged everything. One call and the transaction will be completed. And the second ticking clock you were talking about? Arnie asked. The banks I've spoken with are fully aware of the scale and scope of this crisis. I have received personal assurances from each of them that they won't act unilaterally, but they will only give us until end of business today to work out some kind of a solution. And I've reached out to my counterparts at the ECB and the BOJ, Moorcroft said. They also agree to abstain from any unilateral action until we can coordinate our response. The question remains, what is it we want to do? How long do we have to fix this thing? The sooner the better, obviously, but what's the absolute outer limit of time we have to come up with something?
It's Wednesday, Hodges said. If we could come up with some plausible reason for an extended global bank and market holiday through the weekend, we'd be pushing it. I'd say before markets open Monday morning would be the absolute outer limit, and that's assuming we can get the Russians and Chinese on board.
Ryan checked his watch. Just under 119 hours to save the world. No wonder you guys were sweating buckets when we came in.
Ryan rubbed his chin, thinking. Can your technical people come up with some kind of story about a computer virus that's playing havoc in the international banking community?
That kind of news could cause a panic all on its own, Hodges warned.
Not if we say it's contained, that all records are digitized and in order, and that no one has lost any money. We'll tell them that in order to purge the system, we need to shut it all down. Something along those lines. I'm not a computer guy. It just has to be believable to the average Joe to avoid a mass run on the banks and a general panic.
We can get the big banks and Wall Street behind this, Arnie said. They can make announcements in support of all of this, and they'll do it because it's their bacon in the frying pan.
Assuming we can convince the whole world to stop banking until next Monday.
Then what? Hodges asked. How do we restore the $5 trillion losses to the banks?
Ryan smiled. That's the easy part.
Easy? Arnie asked. How?
We create our own $5 trillion string of ones and zeros, Ryan said.
What? Just create $5 trillion, Arnie snapped his fingers. Like that? How is that even possible?
Modern money is a kind of fiction. It's a story we tell ourselves to keep away the scary monsters of our uncertainties, Ryan said. Digital money, those ones and zeros on a hard drive, has value because people believe it has value.
You're waxing a little too poetic, boss.
Simplify it for a knuckle-dragger like me.
Currencies like the U.S. dollar used to be based on something tangible, like gold. From 1834 until FDR outlawed the private ownership of gold in April 1933, you could trade in $20.69 American for 1 ounce of gold, and vice versa. That way you knew that your paper dollars were always worth something of real value. Not anymore. It's all fiat currency. The only thing sustaining the U.S. dollar is the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. In other words, psychology. Same with every other government using fiat currency, which is all of them. If you trust the government to protect your money, you trust your money. If the government says that digital dollars are safe, then they're safe.
Arnie nodded, suddenly seeing the bigger picture. And if someone steals all the money, it means your government can't keep the money safe, which means people think that money has lost all of its value, and all economic activity grinds to a halt.
It also means we've lost the full faith and credit of the American people, Moorcroft added. And if they lose confidence in our ability to protect them on this most fundamental level, the means to feed and clothe and house their families, then I shudder to think what the political aftermath of that might be.
We can avoid all of this if we can prove that those digital dollars really are safe, Ryan said. All we have to do is create 5 trillion new dollars and replace the stolen ones with it.
Moorcroft frowned. What about inflation? Interest rates? What about...
Ryan held up his hand, cutting the chairman off. I would only do this as a stopgap until we can recover the stolen 5 trillion. When we get it back, we'll toss it in the desktop trash can, so to speak, and balance the books.
But no government has ever done anything like this before. I'm afraid you'll open up a Pandora's box with this precedent, Arnie said.
I think you're forgetting about quantitative easing, Moorcroft said, and the other tools in the Federal Reserve's toolbox. Just as the letter said, we created $16 trillion out of thin air during the banking crisis.
But that's different, Arnie said. That was done to stimulate the economy. If Congress thinks they can just start printing free money for votes, then all bets are off.
They already do. It's called $23 trillion of national debt, Hodges said. But at least that took him over 200 years to figure out.
Ryan shook his head. I can't worry about what politicians might do in the future, Stephen. All I know is that this move will buy us time and may prevent the collapse we're all afraid of. I think it's worth the gamble, unless one of you has a better solution.
Hodges nodded, reluctantly accepting the logic.
Perhaps you're right, Mr. President.
But if word of this gets out to the general public, it will still cause a panic and a crisis in confidence in global currencies, and still lead to the collapse we're trying to avoid, even if we promise to restore the $5 trillion in losses.
Agreed.
Ryan turned to the chairman. Wes? The chairman shrugged.
This is a dangerous course of action that poses considerable risks over the long run. But I'm at a loss to offer a superior solution to the immediate crisis. I think it's the way to proceed.
Arnie.
Sounds crazy enough to work, boss, but only if you can get everyone involved on the same page by Monday.
Frankly, I don't think that's going to happen. You'd have a better chance of herding 100 frightened cats all into the same litter box to take a shit together. And it doesn't solve your bigger problem.
I know. We've got to find the bastard who did this, or it could happen all over again tomorrow.
Chapter 63, Knoxville, Tennessee. Jack knew it was a felony to impersonate a federal agent, even if it was a fake agency like the Department of Homeland Investigations. But he was desperate, and it was the only move he could come up with back at the UPS store. He also felt guilty about lying to the nice UPS lady, especially after she thanked him for his service. But deception was as important a weapon in his business as the Glock 43 in his holster. Thankfully, she bought the ruse. Otherwise, she might have felt compelled to call this Agent Kong and put her on his tail. Since the FBI had been to Runzo's office, Jack assumed they'd already paid a visit to his home. They'd probably cleared out anything useful. But maybe they missed something that could tell him about Runzo's work or any connection he might have to Samler or even Biakov. Something that tied him to Renee would be great, too. Any intel he could find on Rapture would be a home run. It was a real long shot, but worth the try. Jack followed the Jeep's GPS back east on Kingston Pike to Nayland Drive. He followed the winding curve of the Tennessee River along the back side of the University of Tennessee campus, checking his mirrors for unwanted friends. Gavin nearly jumped out of his seat as they passed Thompson Bowling Arena, where the national champion Lady Vols basketball team played. Gavin had only ever seen the inside of it on a television screen. He made Jack promise they'd come back later and tour the arena, then grab pulled pork sandwiches at Calhoun's on the river nearby. From Nayland, they made their way up to the Henley Street Bridge and headed south on Chapman Highway. They made the turn onto Druid Drive past Berry Funeral Home, a stately mountain stone building, and into a historic tree-lined neighborhood. Following the narrow two-lane roads, Jack and Gavin navigated past dozens of cozy, well-kept homes. It was a workday morning, and there were few signs of life, save for a half-dozen parked cars in driveways or on the street. Jack assumed those belonged to stay-at-home moms, working self-employed and remotes. There it is, Gavin said, pointing at one of the few River Rock houses on the street. Jack gently lowered his arm. No pointing, Gav. It's rude. It's also a big red flag. Oh, gee, that was stupid. Sorry. Jack could see the yellow no entrance sign taped to the red front door in his peripheral vision as they passed by. No doubt put there by the FBI. He took one more trip around the neighborhood just to make sure there wasn't a government car parked somewhere or anyone watching from a living room window. Reasonably sure they weren't being watched, Jack pulled into Runzo's leafy driveway and around toward the back of the house, where a one-door garage stood, out of sight of the street. Keep your eyes open, Gav, and let's not give the neighbors any reason to call the cops.
You got it, Gavin whispered,
slinging his messenger bag over one of his narrow shoulders. Jack glanced around one more time for prying eyes, but didn't see any. He and Gavin snapped on pairs of latex gloves before Jack pulled out his lockpick set and easily opened the back door. They stepped inside the small kitchen. Not good. The kitchen was trashed. Drawers had been pulled out and crashed on the floor, along with silverware, pots, pans, and lids. Cabinets were opened, as were the pantry, the doors beneath the sink, and the utility closet. Everything in them had also been thrown to the floor. Someone had gone through this room like a hurricane. Judging by the effort, Jack assumed they had done the same to the rest of the house. He was right. They went room to room in the old house, including two small bathrooms, a formal dining room, with a pool table, and two bedrooms. Each had been thoroughly tossed. Furniture cushions, pillows, and mattresses had been cut open. Drawers, cabinets, and closets were also torn apart. The only good news in all of this mess was that the whole house wouldn't have been torn apart if whatever they were looking for had been found easily, if at all. Jack also knew it wasn't the FBI's style to tear a place apart like that. If they had, they would have attempted to bring it back to some kind of order. That told him someone else had been here besides the feds. Probably Samler. The largest bedroom was the last they checked, and it had been converted into a game room and office. A file cabinet stood in one corner, its drawers opened and files tossed on the floor, along with a smashed router and a broken laser printer. A green leather couch was shoved against the far wall, its cushions cut open. A busted shadow box lay on one of the ripped cushions.
Jeepers!